This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we mark the 50th anniversary of the great free speech movement out in Berkeley, California.
The initiating event of the student movements of the 60s.
We mark the 100th anniversary of the horrific Rockefeller slaughter of the coal miners in southern Colorado.
We interview a woman who produced a documentary film about one of the important Greek leaders of the Ludlow strikes who was killed in the massacre.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
We've covered the Stephen Salita firing from University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana for a number of weeks now. And I know last week, Stephen Salita and attorneys from the Center for Constitutional Rights and others gave a press conference at the university. Can you give us some update of what's going on with that case?
It was the first time that Professor Salita spoke out in his own defense. The room the press conference was held at was packed to the rafters. Over 300 people and reporters spilled out into the halls. Salita was flanked by Center for Constitutional Rights attorneys Maria LaHood and Anand Swaminathan. The press was told that in 2 days, the Board of Trustees would meet to decide whether to rehire Salita. His attorneys emphasized that unless his First Amendment rights were upheld, a lawsuit would soon follow. In an avalanche of support for Salita, it was reported that over 5,000 professors have indicated that they will boycott the University of Illinois until he is rehired. For further information on the case, go to ccrjustice.org. You can hear the press conference live and get the documents that have come out so far on what has happened to him. In our opinion, this is the most important free speech fight on campus since the free speech movement of 50 years ago. Michael, last week was the 13th anniversary of 9/11. Lots happened since then. What are your thoughts?
You know, Michael, you and I could spend a lot of time going after the changes in this country since 9/11/2001. And we're sitting here recording this on the 10th of September. We're all going to be glued to our televisions tonight watching Obama tell us about how we're going to bomb some more people in the Middle East. And, of course, that's what we've been doing since 9/11. And look what it's bought us, 400 al-Qaeda people after 9/11, and now probably 40,000 people affiliated as, quote, terrorists and to real terrorists in the Middle East that we're going to just continue to bomb. And so we're going to make more and more jihadists. Congratulations, President Bush. Congratulations, Obama. And then, of course, think about the rest of it from what you'd have to say our utter attack on Muslims, as Bush too used the word crusade, and we've seen that. The surveillance state that's been created here in New York, in the United States, and around the world. Detention, 149 still sitting in Guantanamo. Torture, and then war, war, war. This is a country that drowns in blood. And as people recall, a couple of weeks ago, we interviewed Patrick Coburn to talk about the rise of ISIS and the jihadists. And he said, you know, after 9/11, we didn't fight the right wars. We let the Saudi Arabians and the Pakistanis off the hook. They're the ones who funded all of this. Instead, we went after two essentially useless and really deleterious wars. And of course, since then, we've also thrown in Libya and Syria. So it hasn't been a good time since 9/11. And this country has taken something that should have been treated as a criminal offense, prosecuted in our courts with real rights, etc., and basically made this world into a very dangerous place.
I remember your commenting years ago when we first started this program, Michael, quoting Gibbon in the famous book he wrote about the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Gibbon's point that you can't have imperialism abroad and democracy at home, and talking about how the sort of democratic system they had in Rome in those days fell to its foreign wars. And now we see that phenomena here in the United States. And I wanted to ask you, Michael, about what's happened to due process, habeas corpus, to start with.
I mean, we're not going to do a very long discussion today about this. You and I could spend a show on it, which we may. But basically, it's over. The legal system is done for. We have those 149 in Guantanamo. Due process has just been completely eviscerated. That's your right to actually have a really fair trial in a real court, unlike a rump court. Those courts have still, now 13 years after 9/11, not tried the people the U.S. believes and who have often admitted that they're the co-conspirators in 9/11 in the attack on the World Trade Center. They're still sitting down in Guantanamo. Those trials in those made-up courts, made-up military commissions, haven't gone forward. There's no prospects, I think, unfortunately, for getting people out of Guantanamo, not particularly after what's been going on in the Middle East. We can talk more about it. I do want to mention two other anniversaries last week that are always, I know, important to you and I, Michael. One was, of course, in 1973, 9/11, 1973, was the overthrow of the Allende socialist progressive government in Chile by the United States in part, which led to thousands and thousands of deaths. And Chile and other countries are, of course, still feeling the heavy effects of that. The Center for Constitutional Rights represented an American who was murdered in that, Charles Horman, taken to the stadium, a young man, journalist, murdered. We're finally getting to the bottom of who did that murder, and there's cases filed in Chile. But think about it, it's 27 plus 14, 41 years later. And then the third anniversary that's always been very significant for me because of the first legal job I ever had at the Center for Constitutional Rights. I walk in there about September 7th, and right then when I walk in around Labor Day, Bill Kunstler is up at Attica. The prisoners at Attica in the U.S., in New York, in upstate New York, have taken over what's called D-Yard. 2,000 prisoners, high majority, perhaps 80% black and Latino. Not one person of color as a prison guard in that prison. And I went in to retake D Yard because of this prison rebellion that killed 33 prisoners, murdered them. The case went on and on from there. But what's interesting to me when we talk about Ludlow, which we're going to talk about on this show, the Ludlow Massacre that took place 100 years ago in Colorado, the man who owned the Ludlow Mines, John D. Rockefeller, and slaughtered the people in Ludlow, or responsible for slaughtering. Well, his grandson, or guess great-grandson, Nelson D. Rockefeller, was the governor of the state of New York during Attica. He's the one that ordered that prison retaken, didn't continue the negotiations, responsible for the slaughter of the 33, the injuring of scores. And we fondly, or unfondly rather, and derogatorily and correctly so, I refer to Nelson D. Rockefeller as the butcher of Attica. His great-granddad, I guess, was the butcher of Ludlow. So they have terrific genetic material, those guys, but let's put it this way. The problem is monopoly capitalism, not their genes. And those are three of the anniversaries, terrible anniversaries. And we will play on the show. We'll take a break to play, a music break to play the song called The Hostage, sung by Judy Collins. It's one of my favorite songs about Attica, in which Tom Paxton, who wrote it, recreates the words of a hostage at Attica who tells a fellow guard, don't worry, the state would never allow us, the guards, to be killed when they retake the prison. Of course, that's not what happens. And in the song, he talks about, had they only taken Nelson D. Rockefeller hostage, then they wouldn't have come in here shooting and screaming and trying to kill us all. So that talks about working class solidarity, or at least the ability to eliminate of the state to not care about whether it's prisoners or working class whom they kill. Let's have a listen to a few stanzas of that song. It was never a picnic social, never a day. They never come in laughing. You know, we never taught them how. It was damn hard work and you wouldn't believe the pay. It was early in the morning, Lord, I wasn't but half awake when the cons went nuts and took us by surprise. I never was a one for shaking. I found it hard to stand with a 6-inch plate held right between my eyes. We could hear the siren blowing and somebody yelled in pain. Then it got so quiet you could hear a bird walk by.
They all wore masks on their faces, and they spoke with the voice of Cain. If they come in shooting, you know you're bound to die. Well, I turned to a buddy named Willie. I said, Willie, it'll be all right. If they meant to kill us, we'd be halfway down to hell. See, they hijack a plane in the desert, and the government screams and cries. But to save our lives, they open up a prison cell. So the days kept a-coming and a-going. Tension was a-getting high. I wasn't too worried. I figured I knew the score. I knew they was talking to someone. I knew they was planning a lie. So I figured my freedom was a matter of a day or two more. Then Jesus, early this morning, the whirlybird dropped the gas. It made me sick and it brought me to my knees. The bullets fell like hailstones. I saw the first one pass. Then they cut down Willie and they got Jim Kelly and me. They come and yelling curses like they was crossing the River Rhine. Shut down every goddamn thing they saw.
American playwright, social activist, and author Barbara Garson joins us today to talk about the 50th anniversary of the Free Speech Movement. The Free Speech Movement, FSM, started in September in 1964 out of the University of California in Berkeley. It grew out of the Civil Rights Movement and the activities that students at the University of California were involved in organizing farm workers. What precipitated the Free Speech Movement was an effort by students to pass out leaflets on campus. That activity was quickly banned. It came out that business interests, particularly in San Francisco, objected to the students' civil rights activity in support of equal rights for black workers on San Francisco's Auto Row. A wide coalition of student activists at the university was quickly formed, ranging from socialists to Methodists. California Senate Majority Leader, Republican William Noland, said that the campus laws would be, quote, strictly enforced. That edict quickly fell. As a consequence of several months of student protests, sit-ins, mass arrests mounting to 801 people, the university finally capitulated, and the free speech movement went on to launch what became a decade of student activism on campuses across the United States. Barbara Garson is the author of the great satirical play, McBird, and several historical works, including All the Live Long Day, The Electric Sweatshop, The Electronic Sweatshop, and Money Makes the World Go Round. Her most recent book, Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. Barbara Garson, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Let's start by telling our listeners, what is the free speech movement, and how were you involved in it?
How was I involved? Well, I was at the University of California at Berkeley, and when we came back to campus in 1964, some people from a Freedom Summer in Mississippi, myself from working with the farm workers in California, you know, Delano and all that, and we come onto campus and we discover that the area in front of the school that we traditionally use, all the groups use to hand out leaflets about their events and so on, suddenly you couldn't hand out leaflets there. And the reason we were given was trash, pure trash. That is to say, litter. Oh, you're dropping too many leaflets. Oh, we don't need dirt in around the school. Well, that excuse was so flimsy that it was immediately dropped as quickly as all our leaflets were dropped. Pretty soon, all the groups, and I mean all the groups, the Republicans and the Young Republicans and the Cal students for Goldwater and the Democrats and the anarchists, we all went to the administration, and they very soon, to sort of reassure the moderates, dropped that flimsy excuse and said, no, the only thing is that you cannot pass out leaflets on campus that advocate action off campus. Well, here we were back from the farm workers organizing with Cesar Chavez, back from Freedom Summers in Mississippi, where people had seen other people killed, and you can't do anything off campus. Well, it was obvious not only to the radicals, but to all the students, that some important people in Berkeley, well, unimportant but powerful people in Berkeley, had become annoyed by the farm workers' boycotts and the picket lines, the equal employment, equal hiring picket lines in Oakland, and had put pressure on the president of the university. this poor university president, who had written pamphlets calling himself the captain of the bureaucracy. His job was to balance all forces. So our job was to make our force big enough for him to have to worry about balancing.
This is a huge university, right? How many
27,000 students then.
Wow. Yeah. And we're talking about Clark Kerr,
yes,
the captain, who referred to the university as the knowledge industry.
Right. You know? And so we immediately, all the groups realized immediately that this wasn't an issue of litter. This was an issue of free speech. And I have to say something, that throughout that year of expulsions, arrests, everything you could think of, all the groups stood together. I mean, from the sorority council, I don't know what happened to the fraternities. They did a few little tricks trying to collect our donation money. I mean, they were really bad. But from the sorority council to the Methodists, from the anarchists to the Cal Students for Goldwater, they stuck together with a very simple demand: that we'd be able to exercise the freedoms guaranteed by the Constitution of the First and 14th Amendments on the Cal campus. And by the way, we won 100%.
Yeah, what happened? I mean, so you did this. This is in the fall, right, of 64. And
now, you'd think we would win 100% immediately, since everybody on campus agrees with that. Who disagrees? But, you know, it is a matter of power balancing. We had all these faculty members who would come to us saying, essentially, you're right, but be nice, go home. You know, and then the other side, you know. And so we had some people, we would say, you be the crazy when he comes. You say, we're not backing down no matter what, you know, and things like that. So we created a counter force, and everybody stayed with it. And the force was completely rational. And we had also, I don't believe in the cult of the personality, but Mario Savio really was special. He didn't believe in the cult of the personality either.
Who was Mario Savio?
Mario Savio,
a lot of our listeners
was
won't know.
One of many who, to go back to the history of it, one day we set out our tables, the tables that were no longer allowed to pass out literature. And Jack Weinberg, who was the head of Campus Corps, the head, you know, we didn't believe in having heads, but he was the brain of Campus Corps.
He was the guy, Michael, that said the famous words, don't trust anybody over 30.
Oh, he didn't actually say them, but yes, he's the one that's quoted as having said that.
And by Corps, you mean the Congress on racial equality.
So we set out a very large table. The other people, in the spirit of taking their civil disobedience penalties, had decided that they would give their names to the people who came around and asked for their names. Now, that had been going on, and people had given their names, and then they would be expelled over Christmas in the idea that nobody would remember, and students don't remember at the end of the holidays. So we decided in Campus Corps not to give our name. In many people, that sounded wrong. It sounded like you wanted to escape punishment. But we knew they'd have to do something. So Jack wouldn't give his name.
Jack Weinberg.
So the campus police called the Berkeley police, and the Berkeley police, who are very nice, put Jack in a police car. And suddenly everybody sat down around the police car. There are dozens of people who claim to be the first person to sit down around the police car.
Jack, this is the police car that's taking Jack Weinberg away because he won't give his name after he's put up the table.
Right.
With you guys from the Corps.
Right. And so Jack, he wasn't that naive. Sitting around the police car was spontaneous. Nobody knew to expect him to be put in a police car. But he knew immediately not to give his name would be to make them step up the action. And he knew immediately what might happen, because from that moment he didn't go to the bathroom. He didn't eat, because he knew he'd be in that police car for a long time. And so he was, because it was parents' welcome home weekend. So here's this thing in the middle of the campus, and all the parents coming, and we're sitting at, and now, the first thing that happens, because we're all on good terms with the Berkeley police.
I just
police.
Want to remind you, we left off Mario Savio.
Somewhere
back there.
So people start getting on the police car to address the crowd.
Standing
on the top of the police car. Try to remember back what kind of kids we were. When you look at the pictures, we have short hair, we have bright glasses, we're just really nice kids. And they dust off the police car and put a little towel on it so that they won't hurt the police car, and make sure not to take their shoes off first. Take the shoes off. And one of the people who gets up on the police car is Mario Savio, who's been on a Freedom Summer that summer. And the gift that Mario Savio gave us, first is his utter sincerity. That's what held that large coalition together, I think. No trickiness, no Jack Weinberg. Mario held that coalition together. But what he added, I think, was a welding of our life with the lives of the people, the off-campus issues that we were supposedly abetting, the farm workers, the blacks in Oakland and Richmond and Berkeley too. And he created that sense, we've come here to learn to do something worthwhile with our lives. We were talking lives, not lifestyle. Why do we go to this campus where it has, it's an agricultural campus, University of California. At the Giannini Institute, we learn how to make square tomatoes. And yet, and we did perfect those square tomatoes. You eat them now. If you don't go to the farmer's market, we learn how to make square tomatoes at the Giannini Institute, and yet we can't even collect pennies for the farm workers. And we want to do something worthwhile in our lives. We do not want to be tools for those people. We do not, some people are their blunt tools and do the work for them. We do not want to be their scalpels. And Mario, in better words than I just used, added that sense that united our cause with their cause.
So he got on top of the police car during this particular event.
He was one of many, but he really was a special spokesman. When I say special, well, you know that Moses had a stutter and Aaron spoke for him. Mario Savio had a stutter. When he spoke on the police car, he didn't have a stutter. So that is a special quality of losing all your inhibitions and being earnest and speaking directly that he had when he got up on the speech.
He said famously, we have to throw our bodies on the machine.
Well, that was later. But 6 months later, they negotiated.
Let's finish with the police car.
They negotiated with us at that time to set up committees.
How did they get, what happened with Jack and
the police car? And we're negotiating with the chancellor. Why? Because it's Parents Week.
Right.
The campus is full of parents looking at us. They're supposed to come to football games. So we negotiated with the chancellor, and we are very naive, and we accept, believe it or not, committees to look into the free speech regulations on campus. Well, the president, President Kerr, wasn't stupid, and he would like to have kept throwing us bones. But the regents at the university campus went back to, well, it was Patty Hearst's mother before she'd been abducted. It was all those people in California. It was the Hearst, the women of who did this kind of thing, and the head of petroleum company that's only in California. It was all those people. And they, every time Kerr would try to set up some committee, advisory committee, they don't negotiate with terrorists, to use a more current phrase. They wouldn't even talk to us. So I'm not going to go through all the details, but over the course of 6 months, it became clear to everyone that there was nothing we could do, that we would be betrayed. And remember how nice we were. Most of the students, I would say, not most, but many of the students were most personally radicalized by being lied to. They did not believe that the people in loco parentis there to educate them would tell them downright lies. You will have advisory input and then no, you don't, etc. So by the end of the year, we were ready to sit in at the university campus. And listen to this. Our sit-in was one in which most people just walked out. 801 of us were arrested. And believe me, people were fighting to get in when the doors were closed to be arrested. 801 were arrested.
Including you?
Yeah, yes, sure, including
when
me.
When was this?
This was in the, I guess it was December of 64. Okay. Many of us walked out. Many went limp, which in those days, going limp was certainly considered a form of resistance, and it was really. It made the poor Berkeley policemen work, and the Berkeley police was so nice to us. You could just see the difference when the Oakland police were called in. Oh, anyhow, just recently, our chancellor at the university, I say our chancellor like I'm still a student at Berkeley. I'm an FSM alumni, really, not a Berkeley alumni. I guess that's how most of us feel. But I got a good education there. But our chancellor recently called in the police because of an Occupy tent. And the Occupy students stood around it and held hands. And he or some high administrator, I don't remember, but I remember the quote, had the nerve to say the free speech movement was nonviolent. They wouldn't have held hands and resisted to protect the tent. So this is how far it's going. And I want to say, I don't know whether to be proud or ashamed. The university has consulted the FSM's archives committee. They're putting up banners on the FSM banners on the buildings we occupied. So it's sort of like Martin Luther King is now held up to kids as if he did nothing but sit down. He didn't want anything. He just wanted to sit down, you know. So the FSM is now, there's a free speech day in California. So there we are. And we will be getting together and it will be a lot of fun. But of course, the issues that many did not take care of are still.
Barbara, ultimately, how did you win on this issue?
Well, first we were all arrested. Then the faculty put up $1 million bails for us on charges of trespassing, first-degree trespassing. And eventually, the faculty came out with a vote 100% in our favor. The same faculty who, when we were nobody, I mean, it's just natural, you know. I mean, they really did agree with us. Who doesn't agree with the First and 14th Amendment? They really did agree with us. And then they finally, we tipped the balance so that they were saying to the university, stop this. Let's get on with work. You give in. Instead of saying to us, you give in. So the faculty came on our side. Everybody came in on our side. I don't even know how it actually changed. It just, all the university rules were suddenly changed.
Barbara, you mentioned the chancellor, and that would be now historian Nicholas Dirks, who's current chancellor. He recently said that we can only exercise our right to free speech insofar as we feel safe and respected in doing so, and this in turn requires that people treat each other with civility. What do you make of that, given that what's going on across the nation?
Well, even though I sometimes jump up at meetings and say, wait, I also agree in civility. Who doesn't? It's a nice phrase to raise. We certainly weren't considered civil in our most humble approach to the universities when all the nice groups, the individualist societies, and when all the nice groups came, we weren't considered civil because of the cause we espoused off campus. So us archives people, the people who are having the reunion are wondering what to do. He's coming to our reunion. Oh, my God, what should we do? And most of them think, wait till he actually does something. But we are certainly writing a letter to the Daily Cal, the newspaper, saying, hey, these could be code words for if you object to some things, that's not a political objection. It's civility. So we're very well aware of that. We don't know what he's going to do. We're not sure what he means. I don't think he's sure what he means.
I have a question because we've talked about FSM, the free speech movement, and how important it was certainly at Berkeley. But how did you see the next period and what it signified about, you know, college campuses erupted during the next period? And I think FSM was looked at as a model by a lot of people.
We certainly were the first, and it was the most fun because there was no such thing as a student leader then. So no one was vying to be a student leader. Mario, it was thrust upon him because he really was talented. And when people would come to interview him, he would run away. I mean, literally run. You could see he had very long legs and he'd run across campus because he didn't think he should be the student leader. We were all like that. I wrote the play McBird after that and I disappeared, which sold 500,000 copies. Now I want to toot my horn. Then I ran away to work in a little GI coffee house because we didn't believe in the cult of the personality. This is very good, except we also didn't believe in leaving an organization that would be a break on the masses. We literally voted to dissolve the free speech movement because that's wrong. And we saw the same thing happening again with Occupy. From a good impulse, not to be like them, we haven't presented any power to fight them. Well, one of the areas where we left no fight was the economic issues, which have seen working people beaten down for the 40 years. And I have to say that we in the FSM, maybe not me because I was a socialist then, but for the most part, we in the FSM ignored the general working class. And we thought we were doing something for the few marginal groups left out of the post-war prosperity, you know, blacks, farm workers, etc. But in the last 40 years, all working people have been beaten down.
We're speaking with Barbara Garson, and we'll be right back after this break.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Barbara Garson of the Free Speech Movement.
And now, if you go to the University of Berkeley campus, you don't need regulations about speech when most of the students have mortgage-sized debts. When I went to University of California, Berkeley, my tuition was free because I was a resident, because I had been married. And now it's $12,000-something, which is not as much as some schools, but you have to make decisions. You take serious debt upon yourself. You may not get a job when you get out. It's a very different thing because the wages are going down for that group of people. Remember when they started computer automation? I wrote books about it, so I was always ahead of the curve. They were always saying, oh, well, yes, it will unemploy some, you know, troglodytes, but you know, working people, some guys who can't be retrained, but we will be the symbol manipulators in the post-industrial society. Well, those symbol manipulators know that when they get out of college, their work will be part-time, they'll be lower than an adjuncts that teach them, they'll have unsteady work, and yet they've got these big debts. That's what's happening on the college campuses now. And the FSM, well, it's in part in sorrow that we meet to figure out how things went this way when we were so enthusiastic, so sure that we could change the world.
And I'm glad you brought up the economic issues because that brings us to your latest book. And your latest book is called Down the Up Escalator.
How the 99% Live in the Great Recession.
So there's some relationship to what you just said about FSM, free speech, and what's happening at college campuses. Give us a few words about your book and how to get it,
et cetera. Well, over the last 40 years, I've written three books about working class Americans. All the Live Long Day was full of people who thought, right after the FSM, that we could actually humanize work. But I did describe a lot of factory work. That work went away. Down the Up Escalator is 40 years later. It's 2 years before PICTI, 21st Century Capital, and it describes the process by which gradually reducing wages and increasing the share that goes to capital, reducing wages and benefits and increasing the returns on interest and bonds, that money has transferred to the rich. And that money can't be invested in any useful way because people can't afford to buy. So it described the crisis that Piketty describes. And I think it also is sophisticated in economic terms. It tells the story through individuals, this one losing their house, this one losing their job, that father didn't have any house to leave, how people gradually lost things. And then the Great Recession topped it off. But if you teach economics, you will not find anything. You will find normal words used. Your students will read it to the end, which they might not with Piketty. You'll find Piketty statistics when the few statistics are used. But I think you will actually understand the process by which this great accumulation of capital does its harm.
And the book is called?
Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live, and it's a paperback now.
Barbara, tell us briefly about the upcoming reunion at the end of September.
Well, starting on the weekend of September 26th, this is sort of honoring the police car sit-in. There will be a reunion at Berkeley. You can go online to the fsm.org and you'll find reunion events. You can sign up for individual events, dinners, sing-alongs, teach-ins. I mean, we're kind of back in a time warp, I guess. But basically getting to see each other. And we were a healthy group, and I think we'll look pretty good. Anyway, you know, your eyes go as fast as the rest of your body, so everybody will be saying, oh, you look just the same, not noticing the gray hair. And it will also be thoughtful, I think, because we've scheduled a number of panels. Of course, not everybody will go to them. For me, one of the things it'll give me a chance to do is beautiful North Campus at the University of California. I can visit that. When I was there, all I do was leafleting. I never got a chance to see the Strawberry Canyon swimming pool and all that, the botanic gardens.
Barbara, were you a radical before this, or did this make you a radical, and have you stayed that way?
I went to Cuba for a honeymoon. So that's 60. That was 60.
Wow, and 1960, you were in Cuba?
Yes, yes, yes.
Within a year of the revolution?
Yes, and I saw then that things weren't necessarily going to go good, but what I saw, or bad, I didn't, but I saw that people could be transformed overnight to enthusiastic, to doing things in their own town and blah, blah, blah. That really changed me. And my background was not radical, but I sort of jumped into the 60s like that was always the case, and I didn't know anything else.
We have a mutual friend and comrade, Helen Schiff, who I met 2 years later, who was involved with you at the Free Speech Movement.
Oh, right.
Helen said she was the one that pressed the YSA, the Young Socialist Alliance, to put up a table under Sailor Gate. They didn't want to do it, but she prevailed. And
I was out of the YSA by then.
By then, yeah.
They were big in Fair Play for Cuba, so I got to know them, and I learned things. I'm still a socialist. And they always said, oh, once you join an organization, you can't. You'll lose it. Well, maybe I did lose some of it.
Well, where are those organizations anyway?
Well,
some made it.
Read Down the Up Escalator to understand in human terms how bad capitalism can be and what it's doing. And assign it to your students. Come to the FSM reunion. That will be in Berkeley from the 26th to October. September to October 1st. You can join in any amount of the events. And I think we need socialism. I think we're getting past the point. I always thought reforms were possible. Maybe not desirable all the time, but possible. But I think we're getting past the point where we can save the planet with capitalism. That's just a practical thought at this point.
Those are moving and, of course, difficult closing words. But I do have one more question for you, because I'm sure most of our listeners probably don't know about McBird. So you should give us a few sentences about the play you wrote, which is based on Macbeth. But what's McBird about?
McBird? We all love McBird.
I know, but you're all old. This is on radio. People don't see the bald heads and gray hair that are interviewing me. McBird was a play that was based on Macbeth, that was presumed to be against Lyndon Johnson, because McBird was Johnson, so he would have, or his wife would have, conspired in the killing of his predecessor. But what it really was a play that showed Kennedy, with all his beautiful rhetoric, and Johnson, with his ugly talk, to be just the same. It was trying to say, hey, we've really done something. Remember, we're back in 1967. We've really done something. Let's not jump on the Democratic Party bandwagon. And at that time, perhaps we could have. Perhaps we couldn't have. I don't know. So that's what it was. And it was very comical. It was very good. It starred in its off-Broadway production people who've all become famous: Stacey Keach, Bill Devane, Cleavon Little, Rue McClanahan. And then the author, who thought it was best to avoid the cult of the personality. So I went to work in a G.I. Coffee House in Tacoma, Washington, after that.
This is after you became well-known for the play.
I was right, but I do wish I had followed up my play career, because the plays that I've written since then, I have a children's play called The Dinosaur Door that won an Obie, and they are really extremely much better than, not better than my books, but other people can write books. And I do write some good plays. But you really have to have more experience in theater to do it than I do.
Well, Barbara, you're a wonderful person to interview, and your stories of your life are quite remarkable. Really a pleasure for me to hear this.
Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. Barbara, a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you.
Louis Tikas and the Ludlow Massacre is the title of the new documentary from Greece by Lamprini Toma and Nikos Venturas. April 20, 2014 marked the 100th anniversary of an historic attack on workers. That month in 1914, the Colorado National Guard and Colorado Fuel and Iron Company camp guards began shooting into a tent colony of 1,200 striking coal miners and their families in Ludlow, Colorado. They killed 39 people, including 2 women and 11 children. The owner of the mine, John D. Rockefeller, subsequently came under tremendous criticism for the fatal actions. Among the murdered was an undocumented worker from Greece and leader of the strike, Louis Tikas, a Greek immigrant who is remembered in this documentary for his work that helped launch the U.S. labor movement. The story is told through the voices of prominent historians, artists, and the descendants of Ludlow miners in Colorado. We're joined today by filmmaker and radio journalist Lamprini Toma to talk about the film, Louis Tikas and the Greek Perspective of the Ludlow Massacre. Welcome to Law & Disorder.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Tell us how you got involved or how you became first interested in the issue of the Ludlow Massacre.
Well, it was a long time ago. It was about 30 years ago when I first read an article about it. I'm in my 50s now. So it was one of those things that when we're young touches you, you know, you get interested in. And when I discovered that one of the men there was a Greek immigrant, that stayed with me. And then I forgot it, as you forgot a lot of info that you take in. But when the situation in Greece started being, we're not a democracy anymore, you know. When we started losing our working rights, when we started having problems with immigrants, when we started having fascists here, it all came obvious. We were back there. And we thought, me and Nikos, who is my partner in life and in crime, we did the movie together, the documentary together, he's the director, we thought that we didn't have to say anything. We could let history say everything about a people of immigrants like Greeks and how they suffered and how they fought for their rights, in a way, along with other people. So that's how it became relevant to us now, not as something that you know from history, but as something that you have to put in your life and you have to say to the others, see, this is what happened and we mustn't let it happen again.
You titled your movie Louis Tikas and the Ludlow Massacre. Tell us a little bit about Louis Tikas.
Palikari. We call it Palikari, Louis Tikas and the Ludlow Massacre. Palikari is a word we use in Greek for young men in their prime who also are very heroic, are very, you know, they stand in their ground in a way. So we use that word. Louis Tikas, his name was Ilias Anastasios Padidakis in Greek. I don't expect you to say that. He left from Crete, late 19th century, and went to New York and from there to Colorado, where he got involved with the unions, and he started organizing the Greeks when he saw how hard things were, especially for the miners. Most of the Greeks at the time were going there to work at the railroad or at the mines. And he was a man of peace and a man of justice, I can say. He was murdered brutally by the men of the Rockefellers at the time, at the Ludlow Massacre. And he was, I don't know, everybody speaks about him as if he was one of those heroes that we never had the chance to meet, you know. So in this work of ours, we're trying to let the people meet him and see how wonderful a man can be to his fellow man without being a big name or someone, you know, that the history writes with gold letters.
Let me back up for a second. What was the Ludlow Massacre?
What was the Ludlow Massacre? You're American. You're not allowed to ask this question.
I'm an American 100 years later.
Some of our listeners may not be from this country, may not understand.
Okay, I'm sorry. But I think it's something Greeks are allowed to do this question, but I think that you're not, because Howard Zinn speaks about it, and there's so many people that wrote about it. And you have this wonderful book by Zis Papanikolaos named Buried and Sung, which is about Ludlow Massacre. And there's the song from Woody Guthrie, the Ludlow Massacre.
We're going to play the song, but now we're going to ask you what the Ludlow Massacre
was. Okay. The Ludlow Massacre was a massacre that occurred when Colorado Fuel and Iron Company, which belonged to the Rockefellers, tried to stop or to destroy the efforts of the miners who were striking at the time to win some working rights for themselves. At the time that John Rockefeller Sr. was passing his power to John Rockefeller Jr., it was in 1914 that they, Baldwin Phelps, the thugs of the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company of the Rockefellers, attacked the miners. It was the second day of the Greek Easter, a very important time for Greek immigrants. Louis Tikas was the first to be killed among the union men, because he was targeted by the leader of the Baldwin Phelps and the other thugs there, a guy named Linderfeld. He was not the only one. We don't know exactly, but the accounts say 19 to 26 people, some of them small kids. We have a three-month-old kid dead at the time. Two women and 11 children actually were in the same tent, and they all burned to death. And it's a history event that shows how hard things were, and still are, in my opinion, for the working class. After that, there was the Cold War, they call it, a war of about 10 days. All the miners took guns, they went on the streets, and we had more violent deaths in both sides. Howard Zinn says it's the most, I cannot say that in English. He called it, I think, the bloodiest.
Well, it was clearly a brutal series of murders perpetrated at the hand of
John D. Rockefeller, who owned Standard Oil and a number of other companies.
Yes, yes. The robber baron, I think. It's the English.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Precisely. We're speaking with Lamprini Thomas, who produced the movie Louis Tikas and the Ludlow Massacre. Louis Tikas was an undocumented Greek worker working in southern Colorado and trying to form a union of the mine workers down there, and John D. Rockefeller, who owned the company, as a matter of principle, did not want the union. And when he was asked by a congressional committee later on after the massacre, how are you willing to do this? Is it worth it? And would you be willing to kill all the workers and destroy your company to prevent the union? He said yes.
He said it is a great principle.
Yeah.
He was a man of principle. The kind of principle he had was different, though, from the principle that Louis had. Louis was a man of principle, too.
Can you describe briefly what role, if any, that women played in this?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Actually, I insisted on putting that in the film because, you know, men forget us sometimes. So it was very important because it was a time of great change, not only for the workers, but for women, too. And as Annelise Bonacista, historian, says in the film, we were inferior in the same way that the workers were inferior. You know, the blue-collar people were inferior. The immigrant workers were inferior. So when the strike went on, it was a strike of 1 year and 3 months, actually. It was a long time. Women were the ones that had to keep the house, to keep the children fed, to have their men, you know, their spirits up of their men, to take their place when they were arrested, because we had a lot of arrests and imprisonments, and then they were leaving them, and then again, you know. So they're gaining a voice. It was a time that women were starting to have a voice. And it's very interesting the way that when the working rights move on, all rights start to move on. When we gain working rights, all of our rights are coming, you know, more rights are getting to all people. They're connected in a way, I think.
tell us what it was like to interview the descendants of the Ludlow miners for your film.
Oh, it was moving. Very moving. Actually, there was one moment. I know that journalists shouldn't do that, but while Annalise Bonacista was crying, explaining the story of her great-grandfather, I started crying too, and we had to stop. Because one of the wonderful things is how peoples, all peoples, can save in their memory the most important things. You know, a question I asked everybody, and I think you can find it there in what the descendants said, is who was the winner there? And I think that most of people think that Rockefeller was the winner. You know, he killed them. The strike was stopped. But it was not, because history is the judge there. And history decided, and that's what the family saw, how it survived in memory shows. History decided the winner is the workers here. And that was the most important thing from what we had from the families, I think.
You know, they called out the National Guard and the militia. The workers were armed and defended themselves and went into the foothills in battles that lasted for 10 days, and they were finally disarmed. Big Bill Haywood, the leader of the Western Federation of Miners and one of the leaders of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, later on said it was an irreconcilable class struggle. And I wanted to know what the people you interviewed thought about that kind of struggle.
You know, for some reason, they never speak about class war in the United States. They use other phrases. We call it class war in Europe. But all of them were describing the same thing, a class war. The interesting thing is they're not political, all of them. Like one of our interviewees, she is a devoted Catholic. But the way she sees those events, because of the family and the feeling who manages to survive one century later, is that of, I don't know, extreme leftists, you can say, is the way that we save history that they have. And most importantly, I think, it's the way that they still, those people who had those experiences through their grandfathers and their fathers, is the way they still see the world. That's why we won there, I think. And I have to say, Louise, there's an idea, maybe. I'm not sure we didn't manage to find if it's true, but some say that Louis was a wobbly too.
You know, when you read about Louis, who's one of the major organizers who was out there, the Greek man Louis Tikas, it says he was the main organizer for what was called the UMWA, which I guess United Mine Workers of America. But perhaps he was a wobbly. But I forgot if you mentioned how did Louis die?
He was trying to stop the war. It was actually a fight, a war. He was trying to stop the bloodshed and the fires and everything. And he took a white flag and started moving towards the guard. And when he went there, he had two men with him, Union men, both of them. But when he went there near to Linderfield, Lindenfeld didn't speak to him. He just took his gun and hit him on his head. And then they told him to leave, to Louis and both the other men. And as they started leaving, they shot them in the back. They died, all three of them, there. And they have left their bodies there, lying for days, until the train company who was passing nearby asked them to move them because the people in the trains were not disgusted by the image of those people there, you know. And the most wonderful thing happened afterwards. The day he died in April 20, 1914. He was murdered, actually, on April 20, 1914. April 27, it was his funeral. And there's one of the most beautiful pictures you can see is this funeral. I know it sounds strange, but there's thousands of miners in their good costumes, you know, black costumes, white shirts, behind him. I mean, it's about 5 or 6 miles that you see man after man after man paying their respect to the wonderful Greek boy.
We're speaking with Lamprini Toma, who, along with her companion Nikos Venturas, produced the movie Louis Tikas and the Ludlow Massacre. Where can we see this movie in the United States? And tell us, when is it coming out? Where is it going to play? How's it been doing?
Oh, our premiere will be in the CUNY, the Grad Center in Manhattan, on September 19th. And we're expecting to see you there.
Well, we're expecting to see you.
And then we're going to Detroit, where the Cretans, because he was a Cretan, are organizing a screening in the Troy Center. The
he was
Troy,
a what? Wait, so, slow down. What? He was? Oh, he was from Crete.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, he was from Crete.
Okay, when you say he was a Cretan, you know, that has, like, different meanings in the United States.
No, he was from Crete. He was from Crete. And so the Cretans in Detroit, he's a compatriot, you know. They want to honor him, so the film will be shown there on the 21st at the Troy Communal Center. And then we're going to Norfolk, Virginia, where the Good Community organizes again a screening. And then off to San Francisco. There's a colloquium about the Ludlow Massacre there, and they were kind enough to invite us there at the State University of San Francisco. And then on to Chicago and Kansas City, and back in New York, from what I know.
Great. Is there a website that people can check this out
yes,
on?
Yes, yes.
And what is it?
It's the palikari.org.
Spell that for us.
P-A-L-I-K-A-L-I-R-I. It will be easier. In 2 days, we will have ready the nonorganicproductions.com, which is the production company site. They can find us there and find everything there.
Is that all one word, nonorganicproductions.com?
Yeah, like one word, nonorganic production. You know, coal is organic. And
yes, I understand. Well, we will link to that on our website, lawanddisorder.org. And we're very grateful, Lamprini, for the good work you're doing and for your coming on Law and Disorder. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and I'm sorry for my English.
No, that's better than our Greek.
Really, well, thank you very much, and I'm really glad good you made this important bye. Film. And while you think everybody in America knows about this, very few people do.
Well, more are going to know now. Thank you so much, Lamprini.
Thank you.
Yeah, take it easy.
Bye-bye.
The great American songwriter, Woody Guthrie, wrote one of his best songs about the Ludlow Massacre.
It was early springtime and the strike was on. It drove us miners out of doors, out from the houses that the company owned. We moved into tents up at old Ludlow. I was worried bad about my children, soldiers guarding the railroad bridge. Every once in a while a bullet would fly, kick up gravel under my feet. We were so afraid you'd kill our children, dug us a cave that's 7 foot deep, carried our young ones and a pregnant woman down inside the cave to sleep. That very night you soldiers waited till all us miners was asleep. You snuck around our little tent town, soaked our tents with your kerosene. You struck a match and the blaze it started. You pulled the triggers of your Gatling guns. I made a run for the children, but a firewall stopped me. 13 children died from your guns. I carried my blanket to a wire fence corner, watched the fire till the blaze died down. I helped some people drag their belongings while your bullets killed us all around. I never will forget the look on the faces of the men and women that awful day, when we stood around to preach their funeral and to lay the corpse of the dead away. We We told the Colorado governor to phone the president. Tell him call off his National Guard. But the National Guard belonged to the governor, so he didn't try so very hard. Our women from Trinidad, they hauled some potatoes up to Wallensburg in a little cart. They sold their potatoes and brought some guns back, and they put a gun in every hand. State soldiers jumped us in the wire fence corners, did not know that we had these guns. And the redneck miners mowed down them troopers. You should have seen them poor boys run. We took some cement and walled the cave up, where you killed these 13 children inside. I said, God bless the Mine Workers Union. Then I hung my head and cried.